You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Many of you will know Asher Trelevan from his weird and wonderful Edinburgh shows or from his work with Robin Ince's book club. But in the last year, he's also been hammering the circuit in Britain with very visible consequences. He's better than ever. And here is Asher Trelevan. Let's talk about what's just happened in the last 2 minutes or the last day.
Yes.
Tell me what's going on with Edinburgh.
So, I've decided this year not to go to Edinburgh, and this will be the first time I haven't been in 7 years. This would have been my 8th year on the trot.
Okay.
Because I've got some TV stuff here that I'm working on. But most importantly, I can't answer the question, go to the Edinburgh Fringe because? I don't have an answer for it. I don't know why that I want to go, and so it's been really strange and really difficult, like super hard, because there's so much fear compacting in on top of fear. There's the fear of failing at the Fringe, the fear of financially failing, which is also bad, the fear of not being able to come back, the fear of losing your place in the queue,
yeah,
the fear of stopping this idea of exponential building and your fan base and all of that bullshit, which might be true, might not be true. No one has any idea except for people pulling serious strings as to whether you're growing or, you know, you can look at your numbers, but you don't know if you're going to go back next year and have a big year. So it's been a really difficult decision to make.
And you're coming to this from having had successful Edinburghs in the past, enjoyable Edinburghs in the past, and also ones that you didn't enjoy.
Yeah, well, last
year. So, you're not kind of going, hey, what's Edinburgh? You're an insider. You've done it for years.
Yeah, I've done it for a while. My first solo show year there was marvellous. I've worked with Robin Ince and the Book Club guys there as well. That was really great. I've been at one part of variety shows there with people like Ali McGregor. And last year I had a disastrous time there. I had my first properly rough year.
Okay. Can you tell us why that is? Or do you know what it is?
Oh, look, the show wasn't really good enough. You know, like, it was an okay show.
It was a great show. I liked it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I know. But it was like it wasn't like you got to see this thing. It was like 50% funny and half interesting. And it was the kind of show that I thought, you know what, if people have seen me before, they'll come and see this and they'll like it. But it was a time slot, 4:30 really didn't work for me.
That's true.
It just didn't work. For whatever reasons, it didn't work. But the show, I got middling reviews and, you know, at the start of the month when you just look in and you just, like, you do one show, you did like one or two shows, you're finding your feet, you're making your muffins, you're doing your little cat dance, getting settled in, and you just think, you know what? This is going to be shit for a whole month. I'm going to have to suck a bag, like, just chow down on dicks for a whole month. This is going to be terrible.
At what point did you realise that? Right at the beginning?
Three shows in.
Three shows in. And did you come to the festival before those shows believing in the show?
Oh, yeah.
Because I say this not just as your friend. That was a good show. That was one of my favourite shows of yours. And it got buried. And we're right into it already in the first 2 minutes, which is fine. But how much have you still got faith in that show as a piece of work?
Yeah,
do you still believe that that was a good show? Because it sounds to me like just in the last couple of minutes, you've kind of gone, the show wasn't good enough. That wasn't it. It wasn't that the show wasn't good enough. But do you think you've come to believe that because it went, you had a bad time?
Well, it wasn't a show that could fight against the situation that it was in. It couldn't, it didn't pull the people in. Like maybe if I'd had a better time slot in a different venue, in a different world, in a different time, whatever. Like, hypotheticals are a waste of our time. But for whatever reason, the show just didn't work. Every now and then, shows don't work. People come out here to Melbourne.
Do you mean Rod Gilbert? Financially? No, in every way.
People didn't come. It lost money. I mean, like, Rod Gilbert came to Melbourne and had a rough time. Like, you can have epic shows, and I'm not comparing myself to that in any way. I'm just using it as an example.
Yeah.
You know,
like the show was good enough.
The show was a good show, and the people around me believed in the show, but it just didn't catch a fire. It didn't work. You know, it just didn't happen there. And that's show business. You know, it's a long game. The scores are rigged. No one knows when it finishes. Like
it's always painful,
forever.
Hideous for everyone involved. Yeah.
You know, if you don't know that about show business, you're kind of living in a fantasy world.
Okay. I've just realised you're one of those interviewees who just finishes talking. There's a couple of people when I interviewed, listeners of the podcast will know, when I interviewed Hannibal Buress, he does this thing of going, so that's that, and he's looking at me, and I as an interviewer go, oh fuck, what's my next thing? So you've just decided, when you decided today?
I decided last night. I wrote all my emails.
Was there a framework for you being about to go?
Yeah, I was about to go, and I was waiting on some TV stuff, and also I was feeling a bit nervous about the season.
Yeah.
And so I wrote to Ryan at the Pleasance after hassling him. Like, I felt so terrible doing this. And I know someone will pick up that time.
Yeah.
And they will probably have a really great time in the Pleasance Courtyard because I love that spot. You know, I really like that place. But writing to everyone and saying that you're not going to do it was so kind of... Like, I felt simultaneously crushed and elated.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I felt really happy not to have that stress because, you know, you say what you want. You have whatever your little mottos and your sayings about functioning in Edinburgh during the Fringe. It is a really hard job. Like, it's a crazy hard job.
Mm.
What do? You have to go out and make a thing that you don't even know what it is. You don't even know if it's going to work. You can do it for years and still not be good at it. And you have to make a new thing each year. Mm-hmm. And then you have to take it to different places with different senses of humor, different priorities, different things are fresh. There's a different movement happening there and try and make it work. Like it's a hard job. So it was hard to write those letters to Ryan and my promoters over there, Mick Perrin, because I just get that feeling, if I write to these guys and I say, I'm not doing it, is there a part of them that's just going to be like, all right, he's done. You know, like, it's that fear. Like, you just have that fear, like, if I stop doing this for, like, 1 year or 2 years, and you know it's ridiculous. If I stop doing this for a year, is everything going to pass me by? Is my time in the sun, you know, is my place in the queue missed? And it's all bullshit and paranoia. But
there's nothing else because there's no actual structure. We talked about this before, just hanging out, about how there's no... you don't know how well you're doing. You have to set your own goals. You've no idea how well you're doing. You've no idea how much of it's in your head. If you're having a great year, you've no idea how much of your great... It's easy to think, or it's comforting to think, finally, I'm good. I've nailed it. This shows that I worked hard and in the right way. But equally, there's so many of it's variable that it could be as a result of... And you want to a number of things.
It's a crazy business that way. And, you know, you want to have a little bit of security. You want to have that feeling like, okay, I'm doing these shows and people are going to come to see the show because I don't want to play to five people. I don't want to play to eight people. That's not a show. That's a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bad conversation. Mm-hmm. You can't get a roll of laughter going. But that's the Fringe. That's Scotland. Every now and then that happens. Mm-hmm. And I my first year there doing the Secret Door thing, I had a gangbusters year. It went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know what? These people will come back. They'll see my show. But unless you're there working in the UK all the time, working in England and touring all over the place and you've got the TV and stuff going on, you know, like there's so many good comedians over there. So many average comedians, so many whatever. There's just a lot of people doing comedy.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are really amazing at it. So... unless you're there all the time plugging away, it can be pretty easy to just drop off the radar.
I want to talk to you about your current show, your new show, Bad Dandy.
Yeah.
Before we get onto that, just because we're on the subject of the difference between Edinburgh and, say, Melbourne or other kind of global festivals, you're an international festival act.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between you, between, what's the difference for you between the experiences of going up to Edinburgh and being a festival act in Australia?
Well, not too much, you know, like... the sense of humour is a little bit different. It's a little bit more evolved in Edinburgh because it's got the history. But Melbourne's a 27-year-old comedy festival. You know, like it's a smart audience here. They know comedy. Mm. It's very competitive. There's over 470 comedy shows this year. The only difference between the two festivals really is your kind of friends and people at that festival, people who can help you out, people who can throw you a gig, mates, comrades. If you're in Edinburgh and you don't know anyone, you can feel just so alone.
Sure.
And just so, you know, fighting against this thing. You don't even know what it is, but it's just, you can just be totally missed in Edinburgh. Like, you can just drop off.
Yes.
Definitely. You need to be educated. You need to be educated to a degree about how to function and how to promote and how to put on a show in Melbourne,
yeah,
in balance with how much money you've got and what kind of a show you've got. But in Edinburgh, I think you need to be pretty switched on or you're going to have a bad time. And you don't want to have a bad time, so you can't go in there naive. But it's an open access festival, so everyone can go in, and a lot of naive people do go in, which is wonderful. So it's this kind of weird paradox. Like, you need... Like, I'm a fundamental believer in open access arts festivals. I think they're great.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a bit terrible when big conglomerates get together and start to control what is basically a free market, and they start to implement these kind of profiteering measures, like putting out a secondary brochure and charging a large amount of money to go on that brochure, setting an industry benchmark for publicity costs that are so far inflated above usual publicity costs as to kind of beg the question, why am I doing this? You're doing this because if you don't do this, no one is going to come. So there's a weird contrast. I like the open access model, I really do, but sometimes I think here in Melbourne and in Edinburgh, because they're big comedy festivals and very competitive, sometimes very, very creative people can be very, very, very dumb about the way they try and get their shows out there. And if everyone, instead of just sort of shaking their fist against the mountain, you know, and sort of going, oh, the big stupid mountain in my way, I can't get over it, you know, I think there's so much scope for lateral thinking and getting around that, i.e., the free fringe, free shows, £5 fringe, doing street shows, marketing your show in an interesting way, doing your publicity stunts, all those sort of things, which kind of help you to function in an environment where it is very difficult to get a fair go.
Do you think that when you do those, when you, like, I sort of think if you have a great title and a great concept and you do something clever with the marketing as a newcomer to any festival, I guess, I mean, Edinburgh's the vast bulk of my experience, do you I sort of see people do spontaneous, exciting sort of things and I go, oh great, they might have a shot at getting scooped up by one of the behemoths now. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Do you think it's possible to continue doing interesting marketing angles and interesting concepts and rent and returns? I mean, does anyone want to? Would anyone want to keep being a totally indie person? Or is everyone doing it hoping that one of the big boys will?
I really don't have an answer for that question. Like, me personally, I just want about 100 people a night to come and see my show. That's all I want. That's all I've ever wanted. But then when those 100 people come, and they come like a few nights in a row, and you get that little sold out thing, you start to think, you know what? What if 150 people? Like, you can't help but get greedy with it. But I think in the long run, like, when you come in and you're new and you're fresh and you're the new thing and you've got the new thing going on, it's edgy, it's whatever, it's breaking the rules because you don't know what the rules are. I think that's great. And, you know, that's just the business. It's always been that way. But I think what it comes down to, maybe not in Edinburgh, but especially like here in Melbourne and maybe a lot of other comedy festivals and other venues, all the publicity, all the angling and, you know, sort of jostling and kind of trying to, you know, market yourself to the anti-marketing demographic and all that bullshit. What it comes down to is just doing a really, really good show and getting a few people to see it.
Sure.
So all I feel like all that energy should just be channeled into doing really good work, because that's what is important. And when the work's great, people will come.
Well, let's talk about the work then. Let's talk about Bad Dandy, because I saw that in Adelaide a few weeks ago in a very nearly finished state.
Yeah.
And now you're doing it here. How's it going? How's your run going?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. The whole vibe with the show this year was do a funny show.
Okay.
I kind of got
my next question was going to be, what's it about? What's the show about?
It's not really about anything. Like, in the past, like, you know, my previous shows were that combination of funny slash interesting.
Yes.
And my promoter was like, just, you know, just remember, you're a comic. It's not a rally. You're not an academic.
Okay.
You're not teaching these people something. They're not here to learn from your font
your
of Wikipedia.
Which one?
Live Nation here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
They're not here to learn from you. If they do during the show, great, but that's not what they're here for. You're a comedian, make them laugh, do an hour of funny. That's what you do.
Have you ever had a conversation like that before with a producer or a promoter where they've said, hey, because that to me, that's guidance. That's fascinating guidance. I mean, potentially an obvious point of view, but I've never been in a situation where someone has said, this is what you need to be doing. Was this the first time that's happened?
No, I've got a couple of oracles. One of them is Mick Perrin, who I think is one of the best promoters in the world. He's a lovely guy. He's got time for everyone. He's been enormously helpful to me. He's always really free and lovely with his advice and information. He takes time. And in this business, it's hard sometimes. Like, it's incredible the people who won't even take the time like to have a coffee or just have a 5-minute real conversation with you. And that's the business, you know, whatever. And my oracle here is my promoter, Beck Sutherland, who works for Live Nation. And she is excellent. She is, and Mick is, they are both people that I can go to and go, what should I do? I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And they will say, this is what you need to do.
Yeah.
And then it might happen, it might not happen.
Sure.
But it is really excellent to have that in your life as a performer, to have someone to give you good, honest, kind criticism and guidance. Mm-hmm. Rather than, here, let me tell you 5 things about you that suck.
Sure.
5 things that are shitty about you. Like, pointing out what's wrong with something is easy. Mm-hmm. Anyone can do that. Mm-hmm. That's a critic's job. But knowing those things, knowing the good aspects of someone, and being able to give them useful and helpful information without dragging them down or blowing smoke up their ass is a really great gift. Because it's, you know, we're fragile people in a difficult business, and it's really, however you get that, whoever that is for you, whether it's like your wife or your husband or your whatever, or your agent or your manager or your promoter, you treasure those people, treat them nice, keep them around, you know, you need those good people around.
So this is Asher. As you'll have heard, he's just made a pretty big decision, and it was very kind of him to talk to me when he was still tangled up in that. You'll hear by the end of this interview some of the things that were on his mind throughout, and I'm very grateful to him for letting us in, particularly at a time when he's grappling with some of the more challenging elements of a life in comedy. If you've never seen his solo shows or his work with Robin Ince's book club, you really must check him out. And there's never been a better time to see him. He's creatively on fire at the moment. So to Edinburgh. I'm very pleased to tell you I've had some heavy hitters agree to do the show in Edinburgh. I can't say any names just yet because they're not confirmed yet. Just people who've said that they're up for it. And it will, sort of as a clue, someone who I frequently refer to as being the person that most inspired me and the comedian I most wanted to be like, he has agreed to do the show. So not totally confirmed yet, but there's some very exciting ones coming up. Not Kitson, incidentally, so don't get too excited. People email me every week going, get Kitson on the show. He will never do this show, but feel free to keep asking. So there are some of my all-time favourites in there for the Edinburgh live show, which is going to be at the Gilded Balloon at 5:45 p.m. Daily, not on Tuesdays. That's the first official mention. While we're on the subject of live things, remember the link is up on the Facebook group for the Comedians Comedian podcast for Benny Boot on May the 29th, live in London. So that'll be the same, that'll run the same as the Acaster live special. I'll host, we'll maybe have a guest spot. Benny will do a set, do 20 or 30 minutes, and then I interview him about it in depth right afterwards. Tickets are already selling fast, so get stuck in. Crack Comedy are also going to be starting to sell tickets soon, and it would be a point of personal pride with me if we managed to fill it with ComCom fans before it went on sale to the general public. That reminds me, incidentally, we don't have a word for ComCom fans or Comedians podcast listeners. If you have any suggestions, please tweet them at ComComPod. Let your imaginations run wild and I will pick a winner. Yeah, and that's what I call outsourcing creativity, because I can't get round to it myself. Thank you for some very encouraging emails as well. Recently, we've heard from William Reynolds, who says he's still absolutely loving the pod. It's made me so sure that I want to give stand-up a go. Thanks for inspiring me. Though admittedly, me desperately wanting to give it a go has meant the time I should be revising has been spent trying to write a set. Yeah, that's what that show's about, ruining lives. On the subject of the Dr. Brown interview, people are still corresponding with me about that. Leo Conville says, read Dr. Brown by means of its visceral honesty. That interview was by far one of the most generous and giving of the lot. I totally agree with that, Leo. Thank you. I think it was very generous. And if it's honesty you're after, keep listening right to the end of this interview with Asher. Finally, if you want to email me, it's info@comedianscomedian.com. You can tweet at ComComPod. Keep chucking things at me. I read them all. And now let's go back to Asher Trelevin.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So tell me about doing an hour of funny. That was the advice you were given. And that differs from, and you've had some very thought-provoking shows in the past. Like, I think of, like, your last show, just for the listener if they weren't aware of it, was based on the six thinking hats principles of Edward de Bono.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so when we say there's concept shows, there's My Dad's Dead shows, and then there's here's a specific concept from a specific philosopher. Do you know what I mean? And you've done shows before that, which all, for some reason, seem to end in the word door.
Yeah, well, I chose that as a titling tool, just to make naming the shows a little bit easier.
Seem consistent and okay.
Yeah.
But you've done shows where you talked about your balls. You've done shows where you talked about fighting a bull in your back garden. You've done...
It was a sheep.
It was a sheep.
It was a sheep.
But the show was Matador. Maybe that's,
yeah.
And that was kind of linked into that. You've done a show where you were kind of supping from an oxygen mask.
Yeah, that was
nebulizer and popping pills during the show. So you've... In fact, let's tell you what, let's do it in this order. Before we get on to your hour of funny, let's talk about what motivated those kind of shows. Was it a desire to teach people something? Was it a desire to say something? What was that? What drove that?
Secret Door, the one with the nebulizer and the white suit and the one that went really well in Edinburgh, that was a show that I wrote. I really wanted to be dirty and I wanted to talk about Australian macho and machismo everywhere.
Okay.
And so that's what drove that. And I worked with a director called Jesse Griffin, who plays a character called Wilson Dixon, who used to work in the UK a lot.
Yeah.
Now he's resettled in New Zealand. And he really guided me on that show.
Mm-hmm.
He helped me make it funny. Because machismo and being dirty is funny. So it's easy to find material about that to be funny about, you know. Mm-hmm. The next show was called Matador. And that was... That was after all of this kind of award stuff. I'd had a great run of kind of critical acclaim and award stuff, and I was feeling a bit of pressure. So I wanted to do a show about something I was passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a show about Australian nationalism from the perspective of a white middle-class guy.
Sure.
Now, that is not funny.
Yeah, okay.
It's not a funny idea.
Sure.
And I wanted to challenge myself and try and make it funny. And it was an okay show. Some people liked it, some people didn't. You know, it wasn't a polemic, room-dividing, walkout show. It was just a kind of... I think a lot of people walked away from that show going, oh, yeah, no, not bad.
Yeah, it was similar. My second show, was that 2011? That one.
Yeah.
My 2011 show was the show about anxiety.
Yeah.
Where that's not a funny concept. And I wanted to do stuff about it. And similarly, people walked out going, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's a hard show to do. And then the one after that was Troubadour. And that was meant to be an autobiographical show that was based around Edward de Bono's six thinking hats.
Yeah.
And you really needed to be switched on and tuned in to enjoy it. There were a couple of things in there that weren't that funny. I liked it. I thought it was a nice show. But again, it was just taking a simple classic idea and overcomplicating it. And so I liked the show, but it was a little bit hard to travel with. You know what I mean? I think I sort of made it more difficult than it needed to be for the sake of trying to be interesting.
I really enjoyed, I mean, I've said this already now, I really enjoyed that show. And it seemed to me a very simple show whereby the individual pieces of it, the six different elements of the show, there was the beat poem, there was the, you know, that had a circus element to one of the sections, they were all simple sections that all spoke very clearly.
Mm.
And I wonder now whether it was maybe the concept seemed too highfalutin to attract people.
It's almost like you
gathered those things together. You remember, like, I remember I did tour support for Mark Watson when he was doing a show about the seven deadly sins.
Mm.
And it wasn't about the seven deadly sins, it was seven bits of material.
Mm.
But you call it seven deadly sins and there you go. He's very good at, you know, making it seem like there's a theme when actually it's just your best stuff.
Mm.
I think you almost maybe did the opposite thing where you had seven really simple, easy bits of material and the way to connect them seemed like a bit of too much of a wall to climb for people.
It seemed a little bit too kind of simplistic for me and my idea and opinion of myself. So what I did is I did that okay. Classically stupid idea, that terrible fucking mistake that you make when you put your research straight into the show.
Yeah.
You don't just lightly massage and sprinkle it in so it doesn't even seem like it's there.
Yeah.
The research, all the intelligent stuff, all that sort of stuff, that just has to underpin everything.
Yeah.
That's just the stuff behind the walls. You don't even see it. And I just, like, put it up there.
Look at my research. Read this quote.
I read a book from the 80s on lateral thinking, and it was just a little bit kind of... But, you know, that's okay. I got the Woody Allen approach to making anything, and that is make a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Make a lot of stuff. Don't try and aim for a paragon. That's bullshit. It's not going to work. Trying to create the most amazing thing ever will derail you. You will lose your inspiration because it's impossible. You're trying to make something that you think you can't actually do.
Yeah.
So I just try and make a lot of stuff. Like a lot of stuff. And some of that stuff will be average and some of it will be shit. Every now and then something will come along that would be pretty good. And maybe one day you'll get something that's like amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Okay.
With all of those shows. And with Bad Dandy, with this show, doing an hour of funny, I got better at making jokes and doing comedy from working in England.
Okay.
And I channeled that into my shows. I was working the club scene there after my disastrous Edinburgh year last year, and I very, very quickly learned that you cannot waffle, you cannot fuck around in those clubs.
Okay.
And I'm looking at all these other people doing this great stuff, interesting stuff. Like, British comedy is just amazing. Like, it's great. It's a bit mean at the moment, I feel like. I feel like it just feels a bit strange and mean and too big for itself and weird. But it's amazing. Australian comedy is based around British comedy. We've been fed English comedy since we were children.
Okay.
All of us. This generation, the generation before, we're built on British comedy. We're only recently come to American stuff. And you just get good. You get good at being a stand-up. And so I took all of that stuff that I learned through being smacked around and slapped and dropped in the fire and yelled at and told I was shit and all that stuff. And I did a show this year where I've used my skill set.
Mm.
And I am talking about awful things. I'm talking about how they make foie gras and feminism and you know, the kind of the stupid artifice of being a political, edgy comic and being deliberately offensive and politically incorrect. But I learned how to make things a bit more funny from being yelled at in England.
I'd quite like to know what you mean by mean, whether you mean that in terms of the punters or the acts or the management or the... How do you mean mean? What's mean about British comedy?
Well, not all British comedy, but definitely a lot of the mainstream big comedy. It just seems like a lot of the stuff on the TV is just kind of being mean and shitty about people who have a rough time. You know, you're talking about you know, these panel shows, people talking about how fat people are awful or how poor people are shitty and making fun, you know, like, that, it, I mean, just feels, it just, the big, some of the big comedians at the moment, it just feels a little bit kind of, people are being mean to be edgy.
Sure.
You know?
Is this a consequence, do you think, of the alternative becoming the mainstream? Do you mean that these people with the sort of...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you're saying. Yeah. Potentially. I know what you mean by that, because I listened, I was listening to your chat with Terry Alderton, and he talked about how the middle class, and especially the kind of elitist middle class alternative comedians, like to slag off the working class.
Sure.
And I agree with him there. Okay. I totally see that. I totally agree with that. I don't know if everyone feels that way, but I think there is definitely a kind of a broad prejudice against the working class, or it's just easy to make fun of, or whatever. Sure. I do it as well. I mean, I'm being a hypocrite. I do it as well. But I love the working class. I don't mind them. I grew up in a working class world, you know. Many people listening to this in England will think, Australia, is there any other type of world there? But yes, there is. But I can't put my finger on it, but the scene there at the moment, maybe it's because it's so big. Maybe it's because there's so much at stake. Maybe it's because there are people who are really famous.
There's millions of pounds at stake.
Maybe it's because there are people who are really famous that other people think shouldn't be famous and get angry about them being famous and what they don't have and how the people who like that famous person are assholes, and that's a cycle of hate that goes round in a crab bucket. Sure, maybe it's all that stuff. Maybe it's because you guys economically are having a bit of a shitty time at the moment, and you got this government taking slices out of everything and taking and taking and taking and not giving back, because the Americans totally fucked the financial system for the whole world by investing in bad subprime mortgages. It could be that stuff, but at the moment it just feels a little bit weird there. You know, and I went to America straight after working in England for 5 months, and the comedy scene there was just a revelation.
Okay.
Just the alternatives, like, just, I did these gigs, and I did this one gig in New York, a couple of other gigs. One of them was like the worst gig I've ever done. You know, I was at Stand Up New York, and this guy's on stage going, yeah, you got that chimichong fucking thing going on, you know? You got that chingichong, you like to do that? Oh, yeah. Anyway, you see slutty boots are back, and you know the slutty boots? So those bitches be wearing those white hot pants in the summer. You remember the bitches in the fucking hot pants? You remember? You know she ain't on her rag when she's got the fucking white hot pants on. And I'm sitting in the back going, did Ian Dice Clay just drop out of the ceiling? Is the punchline to this joke going to be, oh, you know, like...
Yeah.
So that was terrifying. But then I went and did Hannibal Buress's Night at the Knitting Factory with Neil Brennan, Chelsea Peretti, and Jay, like a whole bunch, and just like some of the best stand-up comedy I've ever seen, like just out of this world good. And you got all these old people going off. You got Kurt Brownaller and Kristen Shaw, they're blowing up. And it just seems that at the moment there's a really excellent, healthy comedy scene in America. And also, Americans don't dislike Australians, and British people dislike Australians.
Do you think so?
Oh yeah, you guys have got the bigotry going like nothing else.
Okay,
we got racism like you wouldn't believe. Racism is a part of Australian fabric, but you guys have got the bigotry big time. Americans are mental. They're totally crazy. They're out of this fucking world mad. But when they see when they meet you as an Australian, you know, like when I go to a club gig and I open my mouth, if I'm properly Australian, I've got a flat accent, but they still know I'm an Australian. I instantly have to work against an audience thinking this guy's a dumb
in London.
Australian.
He's in
anywhere,
the UK. Okay.
Anywhere.
Okay.
Whereas in America, it's like, well, just do something. Well, you know, whatever. Do that. I don't care. You know what I mean? They kind of love Australians. And I know England as a culture doesn't have an animosity towards Australians.
Sure.
It's a chip on Australia's shoulder about England and the past and the penal colony and all that bullshit that no one cares about. But as an Australian entertainer, you really do, in lots of clubs, really have to rail and fight against that. You spend your first two or three best jokes convincing them that you're an okay comedian.
I'm trying to think back to other Australian acts I've seen in clubs in the UK, and yeah, I believe you. That's incredible.
Few and far between. Benny Boot, who else we got over there? Adam Hills, he doesn't count.
Sure. Yeah, Benny Boots so daffy. He's not Australian first and foremost, is he? He's like a sort of...
He's just doing his own thing. He's great that way.
Yeah, man. He's like a sort of clown archetype.
Celia Pecola. Yeah. She's over there having a red hot go at it. You got Tim Minchin there, but, you know, Tim's doing his own thing. He doesn't fall into that category.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's got the brain going.
Sure. Okay. That's interesting. I can kind of see that just from the perspective... From the perspective of coming at it in reverse, of I feel now I'm currently in Melbourne, and I feel as an English person, I seem to be a bit special.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I was like, oh, everyone seems to sort of give me an additional kind of like, they've, it's like I walk on stage and I feel like they're willing me to succeed, and they're going, oh, yeah, it's good. Don't worry about your jokes. I mean, you know, we're all working hard over here, but at the same time, I feel like there's a, I mean, I'm talking about this on stage. 2 days ago, I got a wrong number on my mobile from an Australian lady. She said, is James there? And I said, oh, no. And then I thought, maybe she meant Jimmy McGee. I said, is this something to do with the comedy industry? And she went, no, it must be a wrong number. Good luck with your show. And I was like, how good is that? Like a benevolent stranger wants me to do well, let alone a bunch of people who bought tickets.
Oh, that's good.
It's crazy.
I'm glad you're having a nice time.
Oh, man, it's lovely. It's lovely. So... Let's talk about, we talked a little bit about your concepts and the concepts of your shows. Before we go into Bad Dandy, and I keep saying that, like when we get onto that, I mean, I've seen it, I loved it, I want to talk about the making of it and everything. But is it, no, let's do it now. Let's get onto that and let's let the other stuff come out of it. It's not about anything. Bits of it seem to be about stuff to me from what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not about... It's not a concept show. It's just an hour of funny.
All
I wanted to do was an hour of funny and try and find a way to thread bits together that I liked. And you know the way that I found to thread bits together? I'll just go, you guys heard about French people? You heard about that? And that gets a laugh because the audience is so up on comedy that they know how bad a segue that is.
Yes.
So they laugh. Like, the audience is so educated that you can make sort of... sly, wry, crappy jokes.
Sure.
Like, I'm sure if certain critics came to see that, they'd have a little dig at that. They'd love to have a little, you know, they'd love to poke the finger at that. But I just took a whole bunch of funny things, physical things, silly stuff, and stuck it together. And what I've realized is that even though it's funny and silly and weird, all of the themes are pretty serious, hey, I've got something to say sort of stuff. But all the time, I'm kind of just... kind of making fun of myself and also making fun of people who are too politically correct, who can't have a laugh, who can't, you know, who won't let you even talk about feminism if you're a guy because, you know, all that kind of being too far to the left, like on that border of left-wing radicalism that you just can't even enjoy yourself anymore unless it's viciously attacking the far right and all their stupidity. And I'm not a fan of a monoculture. I don't like a monoculture. I'm a small L liberal because our Tories are a large L liberal party here.
Okay.
I'm a Rainbow Nation. I don't care. I don't care if you've got a Southern Cross tattoo on your neck, a St. George's thing on your forehead. I don't care. Maybe you're a nice guy. Assumption makes a fool of us both. You know, you never know who you're going to like, who you're going to get along with. So for me and my audience this year, I'm just trying to relate some things that I think are important to a broad demographic by putting them in a very funny way.
When I saw you do, shortly before I saw the prototype, the preview of Bad Dandy, I saw you do a 15 spot or a 10 spot at the Rhino Rooms.
What was your phrase? It was like a praying mantis stabbing jokes into the audience.
Something like that.
I use that in my show now.
Oh, good. Good. That was the best I've seen you, and I've seen you be very good in a variety of back when you. I mean, I think the first time I saw you do sort of indoor comedy, I wouldn't quite say stand up comedy, but the first time I saw you in the stand up world was when you were doing interpretive dance to Robin Ince reading from various bad literature. And so I've seen you be good in lots of different contexts, but it seemed to me that you, from that show, from that 10-minute, 15-minute spot, that you are coming into your own as someone. You just seemed free. You seemed like you were saying things you thought, but not following dogma, or not that you've ever followed dogma. What do I mean?
I know what you mean.
Do you know what I mean? You came out, and you did. You were just going bang, bang. There's that, and it seemed really live, and you really inhabited it all. Do you think that, I mean, was I just seeing you on a good night, or is that a change that's come in you?
That's a change. That's what happened after working in the UK. That's what happened after working in the club spots. I went and did a few gigs. Because you have to get good at doing short spots. Like doing a 15, doing a 10, doing a 5, doing a 20 minute, doing a 30, 40 minute spot in a club is a skill set.
Yeah.
That is a particular skill set. When you've got that short period of time, you really need to get out there and hit out.
Had you not done that? Had you not done much of that
before? There's no clubs here. There's no clubs in Australia. Club comedy doesn't exist.
Sure.
Like there are a couple, but not really.
Yeah.
Like working class places with a real kind of tall poppy syndrome animosity towards festival comedians who can't cut it in the club world. Mm. Whereas in the UK, there's a thriving, amazing club scene. People who are, you know, it's just because you're good at one doesn't mean you're good at the other. It also doesn't mean that you can't learn how to do it.
Mm.
So that night that you saw me, that's the product of what I learned working in the UK.
And so let's look at what you learned working in the UK. It's obviously it's about getting laughs faster. Is there some, or you, or what I mean, is it, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Mm. The question for me is, did that process mean that you had to stop doing stand-up with your head in the dashboard? Do you know what I mean? You were, I felt before maybe you were worrying about what you were saying and what you were getting across. And then when I saw you after that process, it seemed like you were just getting things across. You were just flowing and...
Yeah, what it was is just being... Like, you've got to go out there and you have to be funny. That's your job. You got to go out there and crack jokes that you'll know will work. So what I did was just put together and collate my best jokes and just chip away at it, go out there, try out stuff. I realized that every now and then I'd go out onto stage and I'd fall into this pitfall. I'd waffle too much.
Yeah.
I wouldn't engage. I would just metronomically kind of go through stuff in the same rhythm.
Sure.
You need to mix all that sort of stuff up. I'm a very physical guy, so I move around a lot. Basically, I watched a performer called Sharon Jones. Okay. She's an R&B singer, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And she's like, what, 55, 57, maybe in her early 60s. And her output of energy was amazing. Like, she gave so much energy and worked so hard. Like, I really love Robin Williams. Like, he's one of my favorite guys. I really wish I was like Dylan Moran. I really wish I was Louis C.K.
Sure.
With the truth. And you can't, no one ever thought of it. No one ever put it there. I'm not that guy. I'll never be that guy. I'll never be Robin Williams either. But I like the way that he operates. And that's sort of closer to what I want to try and do. And I just watched his work ethic, like how much he worked on stage. The fact that he never switched off, the fact that he was just on physically, running around, like the output of energy was amazing, but it wasn't kind of claustrophobic. And so when you made that joke about the kind of being stabbed in the face with Praying Mantis punchlines, that's when that goes too far. But I think even in a small room, you can be a huge personality.
Yes.
And still find a way to make it work. I just think you get better at doing the club thing. And that doesn't mean you're always going to have good nights. Some nights you go out and people just go, you know what? You're a fucking asshole. And they just don't like you.
Sure.
And other nights you fly. And that's comedy.
Let's talk about likability.
Yeah.
How important is it to you on stage to be liked by the audience? Is it important at all?
In any audience, there's going to be 70% of the people having a good time. There's going to be 20% not having a good time. And there's going to be 10% who don't like you. And if you focus on that 10%, maybe it's different, maybe it's variance, but there's always going to be some faces in that audience who don't like you and they don't like what you're saying and it shows on their face and they're not enjoying it. Other people, they might be having a great time and it doesn't show on their face.
Sure.
What matters to me when I'm doing my job is making people laugh in a variety of different ways and getting the clap and laugh. I love the clap and laugh.
Yeah.
It's the holy grail.
Yeah.
The clap and laugh. You gotta love the clap and laugh. I want people to have a good time, you know, and I'm not the comedian you love to hate. I'm the comedian that you laugh at, like many other comedians. So, it's what's important is them laughing at me. They might not want to be my friend because they think I'm too weird and I got the suits on and I'm tall.
I sort of think maybe that's what I'm getting at. You are weird on stage. You know what I mean? You're you're quite a weird kind of guy. You're a gangly guy. You can really sort of fix us with a... with
yeah,
a, you
know, I've,
you're
got a,
really
I've got a creepy
unafraid.
Face.
You're, well, I don't think you've got a creepy face.
I've got a bit of a prick's face, but I can use it to my... I can smile.
Obviously, my laughter is belying me telling you I don't think you have. You've got a bit of a creepy face.
Yeah, I like it. And that was the other thing. A couple of years ago, when I was doing shows, I was thinking, you know, I dress well, I look great, and I'm a bit of a vain guy. I want to look... I want to be like the cool ring-a-ding-ding kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was making fun of myself enough.
Yes, I totally agree with you.
And now, I know I'm a dick.
Yeah.
And I can be self-deprecating without sort of falling into stupid traps of just doing it for the sake of doing it. Oh, look at my rapey face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. Look, oh, look at my cheeky pedo legs working around, you know. I don't think anyone said that, but you know.
Yeah, that hack old cheeky pedo legs bit.
The old pedo legs, look at him go. But yeah, I think this year I finally got that thing of not taking myself seriously and making the most of the particular way that I look, which for those of you who are listening, is like a tall European man fucked John Waters and a baby came out and that baby is me.
Let's stay with persona for the moment because that you were, it's interesting, you were trying before, you were actively engaged in trying to be a thing. Were you trying on, where did that come from? Were you thinking, what is it that I am really deep down?
Yeah, or every show I was looking, I was trying to like nuzzle in and find not only my way of speaking, but also my way of physically being on stage, because I use my body a lot.
Yeah.
And then that has to sort of blend with the rhythm and the way that you talk and create an interesting balance between the two. So in all of my shows, and they've all been pretty markedly different, even though they're all the same kind of guy, I have really been searching for my persona, my physicality, and my cadence as a comic. And I feel like I'm kind of getting there. Like, I feel like I'm getting a bit better at it. You know, I only started doing comedy in 2006. So I'm still very young to it. I'm still trying to find what works for me and trying to do a good job.
Where does the physicality come from? I know you trained at circus school in Australia. Have you always been a sort of physical kind of a guy? I think maybe in the first few times I saw you, when I saw you at book club, I was wondering, like, is this guy, what am I trying to say? Was you being physical on stage an attempt to put a layer on or an attempt to remove a layer?
No, it was just a funny tool.
Okay.
It was neither of those things. It was me.
Like, you are quite, like, I've seen you dance, for example.
I move well.
Yeah, man.
I move well.
The most incredible dancers I've ever seen. I remember at the Spiegel tent years ago, it was the year Fuerza Bruta was at Edinburgh, and all the Argentinians were there, and all these sexy Argentinian boys and girls
doing their tangos.
They were standing around. You walked on, and they were stood around with their dicks in their hands whilst you tore the dance floor apart.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. Take that back to Buenos Aires. No, I always have been a very physical guy. I did martial arts for years. I was a circus performer.
Gotcha, of course you did. Yeah,
I did all of this kind of stuff. And I love good physical comedians, embodying it, using your hands, all that sort of stuff. You can just... You can be really funny with your body.
Mm.
You can be really funny without it being hokey or corny.
Sure. Were physical comedians among the comedians that inspired you? What sort of people were you into when you were 14?
No one. I had no interest in comedy whatsoever. I listened to Eddie Murphy, Come On With AIDS on the Lips. I listened to that shit and was like, wow, comedy, this is crazy. That was it.
Okay.
I had no interest in any of that stuff. Then a friend played me a Bill Hicks CD about him killing Vanilla Ice or shitting in MC Hammer's face or something like that, you know. And that was great. I was like, wow, this is amazing stuff. Bit of a voice of the counter. That was when I was in my early 20s. And then I started to kind of exist in the sort of carny circus world. And the comedy there is like, you know, those guys are on the edge of the edge of the edge. If they're not on the edge of the edge of the edge, they're furious. And everyone else who isn't on the edge of the fringe and way out there, they're all wrong. They're all sold out. They're all mainstream. And sure, it's just bullshit positioning to try and make yourself feel special. It's just totally vain and egocentric. It's just this sort of self-aggrandizing kind of... it's like cultural minority. They create this bullshit little minority for themselves,
like goths,
so they can feel special. Yeah, which is fine. But using someone else as a sounding board to say they're shit, I'm amazing, is crap. But some of the stuff I saw was just really out there and weird and just really strange modern clowny stuff, like all your kind of Dr. Brown stuff now. Mm. That's, I mean, that stuff's been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that it's, you know, got such a great, you know, Dr. Brown, he's going to make a lot of rich people very unhappy. Very unhappy, you watch. But that kind of stuff, that's where I sort of came through. Yeah. The weirder. And I always loved stand-up. And I started to listen to a little bit and get into it a bit.
Oh, which ones was that?
Oh, Richard Pryor. Oh, okay. Bill Hicks. Oh, yeah, okay, all right. Oh, some English guys. Oh, the young ones. Oh, comedy shows. And okay, it all started to filter in, but it was just too intimidating and too scary to do. Like, it was one of those things... Where it was a skill set that was very obvious that you had to learn.
Yeah, and you came to it as a skills person, because your first forays into performing were
juggling
circus skills, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was preparing for this interview earlier on, and I was thinking I really mustn't dwell on the, I mean, we met as street performers, I was thinking I really mustn't dwell on the circus juggling street aspect, because I've chucked Clark McFarlane at them recently and I feel like I keep trying to shove clowns in under the radar. But you're a stand-up first and foremost now.
Yeah, absolutely I am.
Yeah. So which comedians were around, which comedians did you look up to when you started going, right, I'm going to do stand-up? Like people you knew, people on the circuit. Who were the guys you were thinking, hang on?
Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
When I first saw Stuart Lee come and do a bit of stuff at the book club, he did some routine about finding a ballet shoe and he stuck it on the end of a mic stand and swung it towards the audience.
I remember you telling me excitedly about having just seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah,
for me, I mean, Stephen Merchant came down and did some stuff. When I was working with Book Club, with Robin and all those guys, people were doing... They were the night. They were the cult night. People, yeah, were coming down a lot and, you know, mucking around. And it was great and loose and sold out and fantastic and awful and horrible and brilliant and excellent. You know, all, sure, of those things.
How did you get into Book Club?
I met a couple of girls, Rachel and Bobby, from Little Red Delicious.
Gotcha.
Now run Little Red Noise. They put me in touch with them because I used to do a bit where I'd read a book.
I see.
Years ago, it was my first comedy bit that I ever put together.
Yes.
And I still do it now. It's a great bit.
Yeah.
And they put me in touch and I went and sort of started doing some stuff with them and got along and worked with them. But some of the comics that came through were great. I mean, Robin Ince was just so sharp and so fast and so smart, you know. He was great, but Stuart just had such a great cadence, you know, his skill set. I just really liked what he did. I really liked what he talked about. And then someone showed me Brass Eye with Chris Morris, and I was totally in, you know. And I just thought, man, this English comedy is just amazing. It's amazing stuff, like the stuff that you can do, the breadth of it, the different types of comedy that you have there. You know, I loved the Pythons when I was a kid and all that sort of stuff, but that was something that someone else made me like. You know, you can't, like, most people will like that. When someone showed me the Peter Geddon episode, I felt like I'd found something for me, like I'd discovered it myself. Even though someone showed it to me as well, so I kind of shot myself in the foot with that ridiculous comparison. But it was a really excellent moment, and that's when I sort of started to think about the kind of comedian I'd like to become.
Okay. So when you first started doing stand-up or working in stand-up clubs or stand-up venues in Edinburgh, what sort of material were you doing? Were you doing the book and dancing? What was it?
I was doing the book and other weird things in the show.
I remember, it's all coming back to me now, you did the Space Invaders routine.
Yes.
Which was a black bin bag with a Space Invaders face cut into it, and you would walk from side to side, gradually approaching the audience as the music became increasingly more intense.
Yeah, it was...
So I remember those kind of crazy... That's who I... When I kind of first... became aware of your work indoors, it was those weird things that were kind of, they fitted neatly into book club because they were, no one else was doing anything like it. So when you kind of transmuted into standing up and saying your opinions and attitudes and stuff like that, where, what was your first kind of bit of stand-up?
I have no idea. I really can't answer that question. What was my first bit?
Or what was
of stuff? I did the book for ages, and my first bit of stand-up, now I know what it is, was a story about working with a professional mascot at a fun fair who went nuts when she was being hit by some kids and ripped the head off her costume and picked the kid up and screamed at the kid, then ran away. And that was the first bit of stand-up that I ever put together that was just a story.
So that's, so my next question is, was going to be, how did you write that? I mean, that's a story. That was a thing that happened.
That's just a thing that happened.
So did you make notes of that at the time? Did you see it at the time and think, I'll talk about this one day? Or were you sort of thinking, I need some stand-up material. What do I know that's funny? Well, how did you bring yourself to that?
That story, which didn't happen like that at all.
Embellished
it right. To make it a good story with the inciting incident, a turning point and a climax. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought, you know what, I'll physicalize it. It's a very physical story. And then the next thing that I did was a bit where I pretended to be Quatto from Total Recall.
Mm-hmm.
And I would put this like ridiculous puppet on my stomach and push my stomach out and pretend to be Quatto from Total Recall, which didn't work very well.
I saw it do both well and badly.
And then I guess, like, I went from working in book club, I came back to Australia and I put on this show called Cellar Door, which was just a collection of all my stuff from book club, which was a totally derivative show, which was pretty weak and didn't work too well, but it was okay and it was interesting and different for Australia. Then the next year I did a show called Open Door, and that was the first show that I kind of wrote and made weird. And in that show I thought, you know what I'm going to do, I will have this through line that I'm being sponsored by Bacardi Breeze's Alco Pops, and they have told me I have to drink four throughout the night.
Gotcha.
And I would drink them and become progressively more drunk throughout the show, to the point where I'd vomit everywhere. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of stuff about my father abandoning me. There was a lot of stuff about being robbed. I'd just come out of a pretty terrible divorce, and a lot of weird, just weird, weird, weird stuff. Very kind of, I started to really like this sort of idea of blending David Lynch and comedy together, and the uncomfortable laugh. I realised that I could get really good uncomfortable laughter from people.
Because of your creepy face?
Because of my creepy face. And that show I did here, and it was, you know, really poorly attended, but then somehow from nowhere got nominated for the Barrier Award, just miraculously. And so that was amazing. It was a huge thing, but still people didn't come.
Sure.
And so that's, that show, Open Door, was the first time I wrote a show that was starting to be along the lines of what I wanted to do. It was totally anti-plot. It was deliberately just non-sequential, just chopped together. I just moved from bit to bit to bit to bit to bit. And I liked that. It was like speaking without any punctuation.
Sure. And those individual bits, did you have a process for making those bits? Were they born of improvisation, or were they sit down with a laptop?
At that time it was born of an idea improvised. I wasn't really writing then. I really struggled with doing that because I'd been a circus performer so long, and it was just through physical repetition that I would learn something. So when it came to that, I would just take an idea, I'd play with it, and it would work or not. And I worked with a director on that show again, Jesse Griffin, and he helped me a lot. Without him, I don't know what it would have been.
And how are you writing now? How did you write Bad Dandy? Has that process changed? Were those ideas improvised?
A bit of both, but now my writing, like if I have an idea, I put it in, like I realize, I listened to your interview with Stephen Grant, and that motto, it should be the motto for every comedian. If you think of a good joke and you don't write it down, all you will remember is that you thought of a good joke. Until you see what it is somewhere, unless you have a visual cue. Like, I thought of a bit that I wanted to do about suitcases and how ridiculous all of the demonstrations of suitcase durability are, dropping them from roofs, smashing into them with cars, because none of them have clothes in them. Like, if you're going to take an empty suitcase around, that's great. And I forgot about it for days and days and days, and then I was walking down the street and I saw a suitcase and I went, dah! And then I wrote it down.
Yeah.
So now I make notes relentlessly. I rewrite. I take a script, I break it into pieces, and then I start putting it together, moving it around, and then once it's in its big kind of, you know, 14 to 25 page format, then I will just start going through and punctuating the show really relentlessly, and trying to punctuate it well, because we don't learn punctuation in Australia. And that helps me to get the timing of the
show. So literally, when you say punctuating, you mean literally...
Yeah, I will go in and make sure that all my punctuation is really perfect, because then I get a feel for the timing of the show and I analyse it really clearly, and it helps me to understand it and learn.
So you write the whole show and learn the whole script and then go before you've done it once?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but then, of course, you know, you'll put it on stage and maybe it won't work so well. And I'll try bits out individually. But for instance, the Bad Dandy show that you saw, the trial of that, maybe 20% of that had been tried before, and the rest of it was me just remembering it and trying to make it work.
So when you said, but do you know, I mean, I worry. That sounds like a really exciting process. I was thinking, I could try doing that. But my fear would be that I simply wouldn't remember the stuff, and then I'd be trying to battle my lack of memory as well as trying to be funny.
Yeah, no, I'm good at... My memory for scripts is really great.
Okay.
I have a real skill for remembering that, and I don't know why that is, because I smoked so much weed when I was a kid. My memory should be a piece of Swiss cheese. But yeah, I do pretty well that way. I remember pretty well. Okay. When I put it on, I think maybe for the first two shows, the first two previews of Bad Dandy, I had a couple of momentary pauses where I was... finding my feet again on the pedals, and then I was off again.
Sure. And when you're performing there, are you performing an approximation of it, or are you performing your remembered, your learnt script?
Yeah, I'm performing this is the way that I do it. The first four nights, the first two, I'll waffle and play, and I'll look for new jokes, I'll try out, okay, that's not working, I'll move that around. Okay, this joke's working, that waffle worked. And then after that, cut all that shit, all that waffle, all of that kind of meandering down a place to find a joke has to go, because I've only got 55 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be all of the best jokes in a really solid 55 minute show. And sure, there'll be little bits and pieces, but most of the time I will create a show that might feel improvised, they might seem like there are corpses, and sometimes there are, but it is pretty much 100% script, because for the kind of comic that I am, in my world, with my time slot, my audience, and my position in the industry, I need to do a really good job for 55 minutes, because I'm a partially unknown, somewhere critically acclaimed comedian that isn't on TV, isn't on radio, most people don't know, and when they come to see me, if they're rolling the dice, I need to do a fucking good job. And so that's what I do.
Are you happy?
At the moment, I'm a bit sick and I'm a bit fearful.
Mm-hmm. Read the Edinburgh thing?
No, just read Melbourne. So I'm not really...
What are you fearful about with Melbourne?
I'm fearful that it's all slipping away. My audience numbers have been sort of steadily dropping for 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
I can't get a manager. No one here will even sit down and have a cup of coffee with me and talk about working together as a manager.
Is that because everyone
agent.
Already knows you and they've already made a decision, like they've seen you make your mistakes?
I don't know why it is.
Okay.
And so without those people, it's very hard to get a wider audience. And if people have seen an Asher Trelevin show, they don't care if it's a new show, they've seen an Asher Trelevin show. My reviews here in Melbourne for The Age have been 5-star, 5-star, 4.5-star, like big, big reviews. And it doesn't necessarily do anything for me. So this year, this is my year to really change it up, to try and make a bit of impact, because I'm scared that despite all my best efforts and my hard work, my audience is just drifting away, and pretty soon I'll have to start seriously thinking about doing something else for a living if no one's coming to see me as a fringe performer and there's no club scene here to work and make money on. So that's where I'm at mentally at the moment.
Okay. Oh, I wish I hadn't asked. That's a bit of a down ending. We started off on a bit of a down because of the Edinburgh decision, but I'm glad I did ask. There's, oh, I don't know what to say to sort of wrap that up, because that's a...
Why don't we just redo it?
No. Well, we can if you like. I think that's...
Let's just redo it. For the sake of the podcast, let's redo it. Ask me the question again.
I'm not going to ask you the question again.
Go on, do it again. They did this on This American Life recently.
You can just leave
the whole thing in.
No, I want to leave that in because that's important. And that's a really frank answer. I think I was a little bit kind of taken aback by just how frank that answer is. I kind of want to finish by going, oh, come on, mate, everything's going to be fine. You're brilliant.
Yeah, maybe it will be.
Yeah.
And maybe it won't be.
Yeah.
And all I can do is just keep working really hard and try and do the best job that I can. But it's show business. That's the way show business is. It's the best, worst business in the world. But, you know, I got this TV thing that will probably happen. I'll be all right. I'll do okay. I'm just at a place in my career where I've learnt a lot of things that I wish I'd known 2 or 3 years ago.
Sure, man, sure.
That's the business. That's the way it is.
Thank you, Asher.
Thanks
for being so candid as well. I really appreciate it. So that was Asher Trelevan. It's pretty distressing to me to hear that he's struggling to maintain his audience at the moment and having difficulty finding representation or management. I've always really liked his work, but he seems at the moment to have stepped up yet another gear, so I was very surprised and a bit upset to hear that he's finding it tough. I'm always very grateful when an act on this show is honest about their fears. I think that's one of the hardest things to do in a public forum, and not everybody wants to do that. You can sometimes hear, I'm sure you can hear as a listener, you can sometimes hear people resisting opening up in interviews. Something I find very hard to do when I'm interviewed myself. So thank you very much to him, and I hope he weathers the storm. I'm sure he will. You can go to the Facebook group to get the drop on tickets for the Benny Boot special on Wednesday the 29th of May. I'll also tweet that link. So thanks to Asher, thanks to Graham Crockford and Dan Melrose as ever. And coming up on the show over the next few episodes, David Quirk, fabulous Australian stand-up, really interesting comedy, very, very funny guy. The brilliant Felicity Ward and the wonderful Tom Allen, with whom I'm currently touring here at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Many more to come. I'm going to do a big wedge of interviews next week and try and get a load in the can to drip feed to you over the next few weeks. That's all from me now. I'll speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.